in the coming week. NATO leaders meet in Brussels as Russian attacks in Ukraine continue, and ministers for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation discuss aid and the ongoing Afghan crisis. It's March 17, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Stephen Cook, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Stephen is CFR's Eni Enrico Mattei, Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies, and a previous co-host of The World Next Week. Stephen, it's great to have you on for forecasting.
It's great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
I should note, Stephen is talking to us from Abu Dhabi, and I wanted to kick off and have you give us a little sense of the regional sense of things, Stephen, especially with our number one topic this week, which continues to be the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Stephen, there's been a lot of Middle Eastern activity involving this, obviously because of the jolt to world energy markets, among other things. Can you tell us a little bit about how things are seeming from where you sit on this ongoing story?
Yeah, well, thanks, Bob. I am here in Abu Dhabi. And, you know, the general sense that I get is that there is a fair amount of ambivalence about what is going on and where the United Arab Emirates should position itself. I'll note that the Emiratis have been unhappy with the United States over its policy in Yemen. The Emiratis were subject to rocket and missile attacks from the Houthis in Yemen, and the United States has rebuffed Emirati entreaties to designate the Houthis as a terrorist organization. Then, of course, you had war that broke out in Ukraine, and the Emiratis abstained from a UN Security Council resolution condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which angered people in Washington. And there has been, as you point out, a significant spike in the price of oil, although oil prices are down a bit. And the United States has looked to its partners in the region to pump more oil. And the Emiratis have said that they will encourage OPEC and its partners, known as OPEC Plus, to pump more oil. But as for the moment, the agreement they have that runs through the month of March remains, and that's a problem for American consumers at the pump. And so there's really a lot of dynamics that are going on here. Of course, high oil prices are very good for countries in the region that have plans to develop their economy and undertake a modernization of their countries, which are quite expensive. At the same time, you have the United States that is bearing down on them and wanting them to pump more oil, which will bring down the price, as well as to condemn the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians. Yet all of these countries have developed good ties with the Russians over the course of the last decade or so.
Right. And we should note that the shortfall in oil is because Russia is one of the world's major oil producers and is under heavy sanction now. Not so much a deliverer of oil to the U.S., but to global markets. And that's what's caused this stress right now. But as you say, Stephen, Russia has maintained pretty solid ties with these countries, some of whom are aligned in OPEC. Russia's not in OPEC, but still has come up with some sort of a productive relationship.
Well, Russia is part of what's called OPEC Plus, which is OPEC plus another 10 countries, another 10 oil producers. And so those OPEC members have developed cooperative relations with the Russian government over, you know, how much oil to produce, and in which they all, you know, benefit as much as possible. So a high oil price is actually accrues to the benefit of countries like Saudi Arabia, to the United Arab Emirates, to Oman, to other major oil producers in the Persian Gulf region and beyond. So there's that. And then there is, particularly in the UAE, a peek at the United States over its decision not to designate the Houthis, who were firing missiles that had landed and did damage and killed a number of people in Dubai and did some damage in Abu Dhabi, where I'm currently sitting. And then added on top of this is the possibility that there will be a new agreement with Iran. The United States would re-enter the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which from the perspective of the Saudis and the Emiratis and others in the region, notably the Israelis, is not an agreement that is in their national security interest. So there are a number of dynamics that are coming together here in the Gulf that are related to, obviously, U.S. relations with its partners in the region that are reflected in their positions with regard to the Russian invasion, as well as the benefit that accrues to them as a result of elevated oil prices.
So we've had the UAE foreign minister, I believe, in Moscow just today. Is that right, Stephen? Anything we should draw from that?
Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, the foreign minister of the UAE, was in Moscow today. It's hard to tell exactly what was going on. We have had a flurry of Middle Eastern leaders and ministers who have engaged in what they're calling a mediation process. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has been mediating. That prompted the Turks to get involved. involved in mediation. The Turks hosted the foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine. Then the Qatari foreign minister went to Moscow to mediate. And now you have the Emiratis who are visiting Moscow. Is this really genuine mediation, or are these countries just wanting to be seen as being part of the process because their regional competitors are involved in the process? It's hard to tell exactly what was going on, but it's certainly not a good look for the Emirati foreign minister to be pictured, you know, all smiles with the Russian foreign minister as Ukrainian population centers are being bombed indiscriminately by Russian forces.
The Middle Eastern angle of this, as you know, Stephen, is kind of fascinating, a little bit unexpected, at least the diplomatic side of it, maybe not the energy side of it. But still in all, it will be very interesting to see if Israel, for example, emerges as a broker of sorts for some sort of peace agreement. It's not clear what's going to happen there.
Countries like Israel and Turkey, you know, have to walk a very fine line because Russia is the kingmaker in Syria and controls Syrian airspace. So if, for example, the Turks want to attack Kurds in northeastern Syria, they need the assent of the Russians. And so if they come out so strongly opposed and in condemnation of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they fear that their airspace will get shut down. The same thing with the Israelis. So instead of strong condemnations, what they have sought to do is play a mediating role. The question is whether the Russian government is actually interested in mediation or they are entertaining the Turks and the Israelis for different reasons. And the Israelis and the Turks actually have different reasons. And that is, as I said, access to Syrian airspace where both of them are conducting warfare. The Turks against who they believe to be Kurdish terrorists and separatists, and the Israelis against the Iranian presence in Syria.
Well, there's going to be a lot more strong messaging coming out more to the north next week, Stephen, where NATO leaders are going to be having a summit in Brussels to talk about support for Ukraine, next steps, shoring up the line against Russia, and so forth. This comes on the heels of a series of remarkable appeals by the Ukrainian President Zelensky in virtual addresses before the U.S. Congress, before, I think, Canada. He's addressed European countries as well. And the U.S. came out with a long list of pretty potent armaments that it would be sending Ukraine's way as well. Can you tell us a little bit about what we might want to look for at this summit next week, Stephen?
Well, I think, again, I think that the alliance is going to reaffirm its support for Ukrainian sovereignty and independence, and making it clear that any Russian move against a country that is part of the alliance, which, of course, Ukraine is not, will result in NATO action. A country that is attacked by Russia can invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, in which other members must come to the defense of that country. So it's actually a rather dangerous situation, especially with the Russians coming close to the Polish border recently. So I think there'll be an affirmation of support for Ukraine, an affirmation of the alliance's unity, and an attack on one would be an attack on all of them. And there'll be, obviously, the continuation of NATO armaments that are sent to Ukraine. As you point out, the United States alone announced a huge and potent package of weaponry that's going to go to Ukraine, additional Javelin missiles, other anti-tank and anti-armor weapons, suicide drones, which are basically missiles that can loiter over a battlefield and pick targets and just destroy themselves and targets, millions of rounds of ammunition, small arms. And the United States is actually scouring NATO allies and other partners looking for an air defense system that can be transferred to the Ukrainians that the Ukrainians can actually operate. And a number of NATO allies actually have older Russian air defense systems. Notably, the Greeks have an S-300 system, Russian-built air defense system, which they actually, I believe, acquired from the Cypriots. In a long story and controversial story about how the Cypriots acquired the S-300 system. In any event, the Russian invasion has obviously, over the course of the last month, we've seen it galvanized NATO and Europe in ways that were unexpected. So the Ukrainian armed forces and civil defenses have stood up against the Russian onslaught in ways that were unexpected. And now it seems that the United States and its allies are going to continue to ensure that they have the ability to withstand whatever the Russians can throw at them, save, of course, the use of, you know, tactical nuclear weapons or chemical and biological weapons, which would be an extraordinary step, an extraordinary escalation. But of course, the use of battlefield nuclear weapons is something that is in Russian military doctrine. So I think we're going to hear a lot of messages about and warnings to the Russians about further escalation.
Well, and the use of WMD in the Middle East, most recently in Syria against Syrian civilians, is something that Russia is familiar with. So there's a lot of concern that they might be spinning up some sort of operation there and blaming it on the Ukrainians.
That's exactly right. Some sort of of false flag type thing, blame it on the Ukrainians to give them a pretext to use their own. And also, as the kind of Russian assault unfolds, there's another Middle Eastern angle here, and one that's actually closer to home to Russia, but that, you know, the kind of indiscriminate targeting of civilians is something that we've seen in Syria by Russian forces itself, you know, bombing hospitals and schools and population centers in order to get the opposition to submit. They did that, of course, in Chechnya, then they did it in Syria, and now they're doing it in Ukraine. So this is sort of a template for the Russian armed forces. We haven't gotten to the point where they brandish, you know, battlefield nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, but of course, there seem to be, coming out of the U.S. intelligence community and the administration, indications that the Russians are at least contemplating this. And we know the use of battlefield nuclear weapons is actually part of Russian military doctrine. So it's a very, very scary situation that's unfolding in Ukraine. And that's why I think NATO has been so proactive in supplying the Ukrainians with weapons, of course, but stopping short of establishing a no-fly zone, which is a pretty significant military operation, which would put NATO air crews up against Russian air crews. And we would be at war. The United States and its NATO allies would be at war with Russia. And the president's been very clear. He would like to avoid World War III.
So there are very fine, thin red lines that are emerging that we'll have to see which side deems them to be crossed or not, Stephen. But it's something we'll continue to talk about in this podcast and other places.
Exactly. Well, there are other things that are going on in the world. And Bob, let's turn our attention to the upcoming meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. It's going to be held March 22nd and 23rd. Pakistan will host this 48th session of what's known as the OIC, which is a series of high-level talks. This one's at the ministerial level that will address challenges and issues of importance to the Muslim world. And topping that list is going to be the situation in Afghanistan and getting aid to Afghans, which has really fallen out of the news cycle. So Bob, fill us in. What do we need to know about the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan? And what is it that the OIC is planning to do?
Well, Steve, you're right. It has been shunted aside in news prevalence because of, obviously, the ongoing escalation in Ukraine and troubling signs that that could go further. But there's a very much a growing humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan that has been building since the abrupt U.S. departure, the Taliban takeover, the ostracizing of the Taliban by the international community, and the fact that, you know, Afghanistan at the end of the day was propped up by foreign aid. And so the OIC has emerged at this point as what seems to be an important organizing convening body to focus on this issue. There's going to be something like 46 or so of the 57 OIC members attending, pretty strong attendance at this event in Pakistan. And they're going to follow up what was a pledging conference in December, which had set up a trust fund. They want to operationalize that. There's a great deal of concern about pressing for humanitarian aid and making sure that the needs of Afghans are met. Let me just go down some of the numbers first, and we'll talk about some of the devil in the details, Stephen.
Sure, that'd be really helpful.
So there's, according to the UN agencies, which are now the crucial bodies involved in Afghanistan, global bodies involved, there's about 9 million Afghans are at risk of famine. Almost 96% of Afghan people do not have enough food to eat. So that's daily caloric intake is not adequate. 55% of Afghans suffering from extreme hunger. And this is at a time where many public bodies that had been a stabilizing factor in the country, again, propped up with foreign aid, are simply not functioning. The Taliban itself is a key part of the problem. It has antagonized any sort of civil servants who might have the competency to keep things running by seeking out their background and whether they were involved in any kind of anti-Taliban activities. For example, they have slowed down the education of girls and the role of women in society, to name a couple of areas that strides had been clearly made in the previous 20 years. It's because of these moves and the lack of any sort of firm commitment to change them and to improve the human rights situation, that many of the primarily Western organizations, especially the U.S.-led ones, are holding off on Afghan aid that can be alleviating their situation. The OIC is trying to cut through that a bit. So it'll be interesting to see in the Pakistan meeting how much they refer to the Taliban leadership and the need to kind of work through them as official channels.
I'll say if the OIC can make I didn't mean to interrupt, Bob, but if the OIC can make a difference, it would be, I think, a significant evolution in that organization, which has, you know, for a long time been a talk shop, the history of the OIC, it was set up at the behest of the Saudis to galvanize the Muslim world, not just the Arab world, the Muslim world against Israel and to support the Palestinians. So it's been basically been this kind of talk shop that hasn't really done much on behalf of the Palestinians and has really just engaged in, you know, anti-Israel rhetoric over many, many years. If it can actually make a difference in the lives of average Afghans, and as you said, cut through many of the problems that have cropped up since the abrupt American withdrawal and the return of the Taliban to power, it would be, like I said, something, a significant evolution of the OIC, given the scale of the problems there. 96% of Afghans do not have enough food. I mean, this is a real catastrophe that's underway there. I think one of the questions, though, that I have is, you know, Pakistan is a party to conflicts in Afghanistan. So, you know, they're spearheading this effort. They're aligned with the Taliban in ways.
It's a very good point. And Pakistan is an important place to zero in on because they are both at the center of the problems and being a haven for most of those 20 years of the Taliban in exile. They were a haven for the Haqqani network in particular. That is a key part of the resistance that ended up rallying and returning and ultimately supplanting the civilian Afghan leadership. So Pakistan is a part of the problem and a part of the solution. They are right there. They cannot leave the area like Western powers. They are there. And they, in the past, that has also meant absorbing enormous numbers of refugees and dealing with the blowback from that. Those refugees, some of them get radicalized, for example. And so you have, and so we should know Pakistan has its own Taliban, a separate group called the Pakistani Taliban that have challenged the government. They are a bit sort of subdued at the moment, but I think Pakistan has concerns, as do a number of OIC countries, by all appearances, that very legitimate concerns about the humanitarian situation. But then there's the blowback. There's, you know, humanitarian crises lead to refugee flight, for example, and they lead to radicalization in some cases. And these countries do not want to see the resurgence of the whole period that gave rise to Al-Qaeda and some instances to feeding now the even more radicalized ISIS elements. And there's a virulent ISIS group in Afghanistan that is at odds and has gone to battle against the Taliban itself. So there's a whole mixture of these things there, Stephen. And then there's the overarching need for humanitarian aid and what is the mechanism for dealing with that. What's interesting, I think, that's happening and kind of parallel with this meeting is the UN Security Council is due shortly to vote on the renewal of the UN mission in Afghanistan. Really important. It's a completely different type of mission than it used to be, obviously,
right,
where it was supporting a nation-building effort that was sort of checking all the boxes of nation-building and human rights and governance that the UN is trying to see prosper and serve. And now it's just, it's a triage. It's what are the areas of dire need that we need to deal with? And you're seeing play out in the council. The Security Council, by the way, more divided than it's ever been. China and Russia,
right,
in particular, at odds with the U.S., France, and U.K., which are, those are the five veto-wielding members of the Security Council. And there's been some debates about, you know, the prioritization of what the UN mission there's mandate should be.
Right. I will note, since I'm sitting in the capital of the UAE currently holds the presidency of the UN Security Council. And, you know, there hasn't been much from the Emiratis on the Taliban. Of course, they were helpful with the withdrawal and took Afghans, but certainly not in the same way that the Qataris were. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out in the UN Security Council, to be sure.
Exactly. And it's, you're seeing, interestingly enough, that China and Russia are trying to make the focus on humanitarian and some economic elements of the crisis in Afghanistan, whereas it's a broader-based approach that the U.S. and other countries are trying to stress, and that the Taliban needs to, you know, satisfy human rights issues. It needs to satisfy women's rights concerns and the participation of women and so forth. And there's even questions about the way the Taliban leadership should be referred to. The Chinese and Russians, for example, want them referred to as, quote, de facto authorities, end quote. And the U.S. has raised issues with that. So there's like these fundamental basics,
right,
that are understandable, but it's sort of like at this point, again, given the numbers that we've been talking about, Stephen, I think there's going to have to be some changes made in the approach to get crucial aid in there.
The demands that the West, the United States, France, Britain, on the Security Council are making of the Taliban are just things that the Taliban are not going to do. Their kind of respect for human rights and women's rights. They wouldn't be the Taliban if they were prepared to do those kinds of things.
And we should say this is not the Taliban 2.0, as some would like to believe, Stephen. It's a newer generation, but there are a lot of the elements that are familiar from before.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, to the cameras, they've said we've learned from the past and so on and so forth. But there are endless numbers of horror stories that are coming out of Afghanistan now. And so, you know, to make those kinds of demands and to make aid contingent upon fulfilling those demands are things that, as you say, countries, the United States is going to have to shift its position here if it wants to get humanitarian relief into Afghanistan. Afghanistan. And, you know, I think the OIC, you know, as I said before, has long been an ineffective talk shop, but there are OIC heavyweights that do have some influence in Kabul with the Afghans, including the Qataris, who shepherded the peace talks between the United States and the Taliban and have, you know, significant representation in Doha, the Qatari capital, as well as the Turks, who had also, you know, their motivation was wanting to be helpful to the United States as a way of trying to repair the relationship with the United States and paper over some of the big differences between Turkey and the United States. But they too had the ability to talk to the Taliban and maybe perhaps make a difference within Kabul that would allow the OIC and others to flow aid into Afghanistan. But it's very, very hard to imagine. I think the OIC is kind of a weak read. And as you point out, the Security Council is so divided that I suspect the Afghan people are going to continue to suffer.
Yeah. And, you know, just referring back to Ukraine for a second, you know, there's good reason why people are pointing to the 3 million number of refugees now being surpassed and that possibly even getting higher. It's we haven't seen anything like this in terms of the speed of refugees from Ukraine. But given the way things are in Afghanistan, a little bit more of a slow burn, so to speak, you could see numbers like that emerging as well because it is so dire.
Right. I think that the speed of the refugees coming out of Ukraine is something. I mean, they didn't get to the 3 million mark in Syria after some time. It's only been 3 weeks or so in Ukraine. So we're looking at, you know, a new wave of European refugees in Europe and then Afghan refugees making their way to Europe on top of the huge numbers of Syrians and Kurds and others and Iraqis who are already there. So this is going to be a significant challenge for the UN, the European Union, the OIC, the United States, and others. Well, Bob, I think it's time to pivot to discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet at us. This week, our audience selected Gabriel Boric, Chile's new president. Tell us a bit about him, Bob.
Sure, Stephen. Boric has, I think, maybe captivated our Twitter audience, as he has many others in the region. He's the youngest ever Chilean president. He's 36 years old.
36? Can you imagine being the president of a country when you were 36?
36. And not only any country, this is Chile. This is the sort of the tiger economy of South America, and a country that has also existed for decades under the constitution drawn up under the Augusto Pinochet era. That was a dark period in many respects, but it had this vaunted economy that was based on what was called neoliberalism. And it did create, according to some benchmarks, very healthy economic signs, but also drove inequality. And I think inequality rose to the surface in the big demonstrations that hit Chile in 2019. They were provoked by a raise in sort of a nominal fee for metro passes, and they ballooned into so many other areas. And you have now an element among the things that are going on now as Boric takes office is the redrawing of the constitution with a real cross-section of people from the country, larger than ever representation of indigenous groups. Chile has a lot of indigenous population. And this figure, it should be noted, more of a center-left figure. He's not like a Marxist firebrand, as some might have, you know, tagged him initially. Boric is by many accounts more pragmatic, but definitely of the center-left. He's been positioning himself and in the way he's composed his cabinet, which has many women in it. He's trying to sort of set up a European-style welfare model, by all appearances. And he's looking to replace the private pension plan that was put in place under Pinochet. And he's also the first president not part of the two traditional centrist blocs that have led Chile since it returned to democracy 3 decades ago. And so he's going to be looked very closely as, is he some sort of a new model for the region where you are able to lead the country out of tough passage, to put a constitution in place, to restore some measure or to bring about some measure of equality, and maybe set a template for some of the other countries. It's been much talked about various waves that have hit South America politically, whether you had the Hugo Chavez-led wave, the Bolivarian revolution that hit some of the northern countries in South America, or some of the rightist blowback epitomized by Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. So now let's see what Boric is able to do in Chile.
You know, it's a happy coincidence that our audience picked Gabriel Boric because I happened to be seated next to two Chileans at dinner last evening here in Abu Dhabi. And I was asking them about the new Chilean president. And, you know, they were not supporters of Boric, but their objections weren't necessarily so kind of ideological, but they were concerned that he has set up for himself and for the country this enormous agenda, including, as you point out, the rewriting of the Pinochet-era constitution, which was a constitution that was written under a military dictatorship, and a brutal one at that. So it's a big task for a country and for a leader who not long ago was, you know, a student organizer, not to suggest that being a student organizer is a bad thing, but that, you know, this is someone who doesn't have the kind of experience, and he has set such a huge agenda for the country. But it is, as you point out, I think, interesting. It's not, you know, the Hugo Chavez, the Bolivarian revolutionaries, and nor is it the rightist backlash. It's some sort of middle road. He did tack more towards the middle in the presidential campaign. And, you know, Chile had been, you know, for a time, as you point out, the model, the success story of bellwether, the success of neoliberal reforms, things that, you know, people studied throughout the region and the world. And, you know, how do you do this? And now they're going to undo much of that. And we'll have to see how it goes. It's certainly going to be yet another Chilean experiment in social and economic engineering.
Well, certainly. And it's worth noting that Boric actually came in second in the first round of the presidential voting to a rightist candidate. And there was some concern that kind of seems like it built up. And he also kind of rallied more Chileans, I think, around his messages as well. But I think he was trying to convey this message that he's going to govern more from the center. And Chile, like many countries in the region, has sharp divides between left and right, certainly. And they have a rising on the ultra-conservative side of the country, a rising bloc there. But Boric, for now, is the one who holds the reins. And so it's going to be a real big test. And again, he's 36 years old. Let's see what he's got.
Something definitely for us to keep an eye on. Some other things to keep an eye on in the coming week. Tunisians mark their Independence Day, and the European Gas Summit takes place in Vienna.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're getting podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it, by the way. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Francesca Aramiba, Margaret Gotch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Stephen Cook saying goodbye. Bob, I'm looking forward to seeing you when I get back to the United States.
Steve, I'm very excited about return to office and seeing you. Meanwhile, safe travels to you, and so long.